Welcome to Econ Sound, the podcast series from the University of Warwick Economic Department. Today we're joined by Dr. Ludovica Gaza, an assistant professor in the department, and she's very interested in the economics of the environment, public health, the geographic impact of toxins, and how that impacts on society. Thank you very much for joining us for the podcast and for giving us some of your time. Your research looks at the economics of the environment and public health, and you've done some papers recently on the impact of lead poisoning on children, both in short and long term. Could you tell us a little bit about your work in this area, perhaps how you got interested in it, and some of the findings that are most striking to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm interested in, you know, in lead poisoning just as one particular example of all the things that we might encounter in our lives and that, you know, will end up affecting how we grow up, how we turn up as human beings. And what I find really interesting about lead poisoning is that this is a particularly prevalent issue, even in a country like the United States, which we think of as, you know, pretty developed, where air pollution levels have gone down tremendously in the past 20 years or longer. And yet, lead poisoning is still very prevalent. It is estimated that about 500,000 children get poisoned each year. And what I find fascinating is that most of the lead exposure that children have actually happens in their homes. So lead used to be used very much as an additive to paint. It makes the white of the paint looks whiter and shinier. It actually helps makes the paint be washable. So it was thought to be great, especially in children's room. And you know, as you know, lead was also an additive in gasoline that was used, you know, before cars started having catalytic converter, which thankfully actually is not, it doesn't do well with lead. So that that helped accelerate the phase out of leaded gasoline. So, and you know, even before that, lead was used extensively in plumbing. Mm-hmm. Lead is a very malleable yet durable metal. And so, you know, my ancestors, I'm Italian, the Romans, they started using it in plumbing. That's where the word plumbing actually comes from. Lead in Latin is called plumbum. And so, you know, because of all these reasons, it ends up being, you know, everywhere around us and specifically in private homes. And so that's why I find that it's particularly interesting to study it as an environmental toxin, because, you know, it's not as much something that the government can just clean up on their own. Mm-hmm. There needs to be kind of this this conversation and this mutual support between, you know, government action and you know, private families opening their homes, you know, wanting to do inspections and remediations. So recently what I've studied is kind of on the two sides of this, you know, this, which I think is kind of an epidemic, if you wish, just not as, you know, not as much in the news, not as much an emergency as other pandemic recently, which is, you know, on the one end, how do we learn about lead exposure and how do families learn that their kids might have been exposed and can take action? So that, you know, act of screening, which I think is really important and interesting in public health. And then sort of on the other side, you know, once children have been lead poisoned and lead exposed, you know, what are the consequences of that, and specifically for society? And so on the first work, you know, what I find and I think is really interesting is that, you know, we know old parents love their children, you know, that's absolutely not in doubt. And yet, you know, even in areas, and in particular, I was studying Illinois and Chicago, which is the city I was living in, where I did my postdoc. Even in areas of Illinois, and the whole city of Chicago is considered high risk, so every child should be screened by age two, at least once. Even in those areas, about a third of children never got a test for lead poisoning. And these tests, I mean, you can get a capillary, a finger prick, basically. You know, other types of tests might be a bit more invasive, where you get a blood draw. But these can be done at the doctor's office really easily. And yet what I found is that over a third of children were not screened. And in particular, what was interesting is that it was actually likely the highest risk children that in the high risk areas already that were not making it to the doctor. And what I found that was interesting was that I had very granular data. I knew where the child were living when the children were living where they were born. And I know where the doctors are. And so I can compute the distance to the closest doctor. And what I find is that children who were farther away from the doctors, they are the ones that are less likely to be screened. And in particularly if they are low income minority, higher risk.
Are those groups more likely to be in older houses that are more likely to have the lead? I just think when you said, is that about the sort of age of the residential properties and maybe they've got the lead pipes?
Yes, precisely. So lead paint was banned in 1978. But even before then, the use of lead paint has started declining and the amount of lead in the paint has started declining. So it's really homes that are built prior to 1930, I found, in particularly in that area, that are the ones that have the most lead. And what's important also is that really the way that kids absorb the lead is by ingesting or inhaling the lead dust. And so the better the house is maintained, the less is the hazard for the child. But of course, you know, if one lives in an old house that's decrepit, that's not well kept, if folks can't afford to keep it up, to do maintenance and repair work, that's where the kids are sort of most vulnerable. But what I thought was interesting with this analysis is that what resonated is that now there are recent research that has come out, also coming out of the US, that shows that rates for COVID vaccination also decrease with distance to vaccination centers. Mm-hmm. And so what was interesting was that these researchers, they were suggesting that maybe what we should do is we should make vaccines available at general stores, like the dollar store, right? Like places where folks already go for shopping, places where folks already go for something, and then, oh, look, we can also do this thing that's good for our health, which, you know, could be COVID vaccination or could be like a quick and dirty finger prick to our kid to know whether we need intervention. And so that's something that I also investigated in my paper and found really interesting.
And you were testing out, is this right, that you were testing out different ways that you might be able to change that that pattern? So perhaps it would be subsidies of travel cost, or perhaps it would be incentivizing the healthcare practitioners to actually reach out more to the missing families. Did you find that any of those in particular would make a difference?
Yeah. So what I found was really, it seemed to me that giving subsidies, like, you know, a voucher for maybe in, you know, a Lyft or Uber or taxi ride, like those could be, those seem to be particularly effective. And also they are somewhat easier to implement and target. On the other hand, also, giving incentives to doctors, saying, look, you have all these children, they are enrolled in, you know, in the US, it's called Medicaid, that's the insurance for low income folks. So, you know, it's suggested, you know, these kids should be tested. You should know that, you should have their names, the phone numbers of the families. So call them up, trying to get them. And if you reach a quota, then you can get a bonus at the end of the year. That's something that's been tested in other contexts, and it's been found to potentially be useful. Depending, of course, always the devil is always in the details. I do kind of suggest that there might be potential policies that shouldn't be that difficult to implement and could really make the difference. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. And you've also been looking at perhaps the longer, in a different part of the US, isn't it? The longer term impact of this exposure to lead. So the screening of children when they're very young will identify perhaps which children have had lead exposure, and that has impact on their own health and development. But you were also looking then at the wider consequences for what happens to their peer group in an education situation. So did you find anything similar there in terms of patterns of inequality, or which families, which children were worse off as a result?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's kind of another area that I find really fascinating. So we are now, other researchers studying lead poisoning as well, like we're all coming to the same conclusion that lead poisoning can be really damaging. You know, it can be alleviated with timely interventions, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, nurse visits, like all of those things are really helpful. But, you know, what's striking about lead poisoning is that lead is really sneaky. It mimics calcium in our bodies. And so because of that, you know, the body is tricked to think that they're absorbing calcium. And so they're starting to use the lead to call it up. And that ends up clogging a lot of bodily functions and a lot of our systems. And in particular, it ends up damaging nerve cells. With consequences both for cognitive skills, you know, the way we learn, but also non-cognitive skills. It seems to be linked to impulse behavior and our ability to be patient, you know, to take a step back and take a breath. And so for this reason, lead exposure has been associated, for example, in increased propensity for criminal activity and disruptive behavior as well. And so, you know, together with some co-authors, you know, our idea was that, well, you know, if lead, you know, hinders the, you know, children, these are children, you know, children and teenagers' ability to learn for, you know, for themselves, but also to kind of, you know, sit quietly in a classroom, you know, there seems to be the potential for consequences for everyone else in the classroom, those kids who aren't themselves affected, you know, by lead. And so what we find is exactly this. We use data from North Carolina. We know which children have been screened for lead, which ones had been found to be lead poisoned, and we know who they go to school with, you know, from elementary school, from grade three throughout graduation. And so what we find is that, first of all, you know, lead is actually quite diffuse. So we find that virtually every student in our sample ends up going to school, you know, with at least one other kid who has been lead poisoned. And in fact, over half of our sample ends up going to school with over 10% of their peers in their cohort who are lead poisoned. So this is pretty substantial. And what we find is that indeed going to school, even when for those kids who themselves are not lead poisoned, going to school with a lead poisoned kid ends up affecting both their behavior in the short run. These kids are more likely to be suspended. They're more likely to be involved in a disciplinary incident with a lead poisoned kid. They're more likely to be absent for over 20 days in a year. So what we, you know, kind of a definition of chronic absenteeism. And then, you know, later on, they're also less likely to graduate high school, and they're less likely to take those college prep exams that are, you know, necessary.
And this isn't just the child that has the lead exposure. This is the peer group or the the cohort around that child. I mean, I find that you know, quite striking that the impact is so broad. And again, was that disproportionate? Was it the young people who you might already expect to be less likely to go on to higher education who were more impacted by this?
Yeah. So what we find is that kind of it's a, you know, there's almost like a compounding effect, right? Like, so what we find is that low income minority kids are more likely, you know, to be in neighborhoods with high levels of lead exposure. So they're more likely to have peers who are lead exposed. And on top of that, they seem to be the ones that are most affected, right? Like, and maybe that's because they're already the ones that are at risk of not graduating. And so, you know, just this is the extra, you know, the extra thing that pushes them, you know, off the cliff, if you wish. And so, yeah, really, it seems what we think is that this seems to have pretty big implications in terms of inequality. And that links very well with some of what we know. We know that, you know, where somebody grows up really ends up shaping their future. And, you know, I think we know much less about what it is. Is it, you know, your friends? Is it the air you breathe, literally, you know, is it, you know, the role models that you end up having? And we think that all of these, you know, all of these issues are intertwined. And in fact, now we want to try to unpack this a bit more. We're even interested in trying to think about, you know, the teachers that end up interacting with these kids, right? Like, who are the teachers in those schools? And, you know, if somebody has just started out as a teacher and ends up having kind of, you know, a bad class, if you wish, you know, somebody, you know, a lot of these kids that are disruptive, you know, does that affect their career trajectory, the career trajectory of the teacher themselves?
Do they get a bad reputation because they have discipline problems, but actually they're not just discipline problems, there's an underlying issue behind them. And I think you mentioned there about the very long term effects and perhaps careers, not just of the teacher, but thinking about the students again. I think you calculated that there might be as much as £8 billion in lost earnings for these young people who are almost held back from achieving their full potential. Did that strike you as a large number? Were you surprised by that? It seems huge to me.
So we were not surprised by it. In fact, if anything, we actually thought it could be even larger.
Yeah.
$8 billion, it's about... 4% of what we thought was the direct cost of lead poisoning. So, you know, one can say, is it big? Is it small? But what we think is that, you know, we study, first of all, as always in economics, we have to be careful as to the assumptions that we're making. So this number is only calculated based on that not graduating high school.
Right.
And so, of course, you know, if we think that these other non-cognitive and disciplinary things kind of also carry through, maybe, you know, these kids are less likely to be successful at their job because they're less likely to, you know, sit still. They're less likely to interact, appropriately with colleagues and bosses and clients, you know. So there's a lot of things here that we might not be considering, but We were not surprised, and in fact, you know, we think that we study lead poisoning because that's what that's the data that we have, but we have no reason to believe that other forms of pollution, you know, might, you know, also have these spillover effects to folks that are not affected, and you know, we study children might be more susceptible. Based on their, you know, the stages of their neurological development, but you know, there's no reason to believe that adults aren't affected as well.
Mm-hmm. And by sort of putting these by focusing these long-term effects into sort of dollars and really pragmatic consequences, do you think that will make it easier for politicians to grasp, you know, what's going on, and perhaps to be motivated to take action to introduce a travel subsidy or provide people with grants to fix up their homes? Do you see what you're doing in economics terms as something that will have an impact on politics or on actual, you know, lives?
I mean, absolutely. I wish, you know, in fact, I wish that my research ends up informing policy. To me, that's very much a goal. And yet that's something I really like at Warwick, because I think that there is a lot of support for that. And you know, I think ultimately as economists, you know, we are really trained to think about trade-offs and to think about kind of marginal costs and benefits. And I think that policy is very much about that, right? And so in general, of course, we say lead is bad, you know, pollution is bad, but, to abate pollution, to clean up the world has costs. And so, maybe a world with zero pollution is not the world that we want, because to achieve zero pollution, we might need to achieve, you know, we might have zero economic growth, right? And so really, I think what we as researchers, and I in particular try to do is sort of emphasize these trade-offs, try to get the most rigorous and correct estimate I can of what I think are, you know, the benefits in this case of cleaning up lead in terms of, you know, the kids that themselves are exposed, everyone else in their cohort that plays with them, learns with them, so that then policymakers can take those numbers and really sort of think about, okay, you know, what resources can we put towards achieving this goal?
Mm-hmm. And what brought you into this field originally? Has that always been your focus as a researcher?
That's a great question. It wasn't necessarily. I think I went into grad school wanting to just in general sort of understand more what are the determinants of poverty. And in particular, I thought I wanted to focus on sort of low-income countries, where maybe sort of we could make the difference even more, just because, you know, maybe the baseline is relatively low. But then sort of, you know, as I went through grad school, I think I started to understand a bit more about, you know, again, the role that the environment plays in this process of human capital accumulation. We call it, you know, economic growth, human growth, well-being. And I think I realized that maybe we know less than we would want to know. And so I thought it was really, really fertile ground for research. And I think that, I mean, there's definitely still, I'm still really interested in inequalities and inequities. And I think that sort of, you know, there's definitely inequalities in exposure to pollution. I think that these kind of are related to also inequality in access to other resources, access to good healthcare, right? Like in the UK, we have the NHS. And you know, that's supposed to be, everyone is supposed to be able to access it. There's questions still about, you know, the quality of the doctors, you know, the waiting times, you know. But in the US instead, you know, the fact that there is private insurance, I think that it's really well documented that access to healthcare, it's much more unequal. And so then, you know, you have some folks are more likely to be breathing bad air, and also they're less likely to have good doctors or to have, you know, even a doctor available close by. And so how do these, you know, do these factors interplay? I think it's something that's really potentially really interesting. And so, yeah, to me, it's still about this question of you know, poverty, of how can we sort of create an environment, physical, but also sort of metaphorical for folks to thrive. I think it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. One of the things that really struck me in the papers was the weight of data that you had to use to investigate. But you know, the health of the children, the educational trajectories, what had happened to them at school. I mean, this was millions and millions of records, wasn't it? Has this work only recently become possible with the amount of sort of computer processing available? And what sort of challenges do you have to face in terms of, I don't know, privacy or permissions to actually have that really intimate detail about someone's life?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that, I mean, definitely we are just starting to, in the past few years, sort of, there has been a growth of research that uses administrative data that are, you know, big data sets with a lot of information about individuals that can be linked sort of throughout different sources. And, but you know, of course, that also have potentially sensitive information. So I think we like these data because, we used to go out in the field and try to survey people. You know, sometimes it would take like half an hour of their time, and then we would have to ask, you know, when was your kid screened for lead poisoning? And, you know, oh my God, they would have to remember. I don't know. I thought it was last summer, but maybe it wasn't that hot, so maybe it was May, right? And you would get all these like data that weren't as you know, as good, first of all, and it was also really, really costly to collect for both, you know, the researchers, but also for the people that were, you know, putting their time to answer our questions, right? Administrative data really opens up the door for, you know, research that can study also everyone that's representative, right? At the same time, yes, I mean, of course, there are, you know, barriers in terms of computing times, in terms of software. I mean, everyone who is at a university, also as a student, you know, they will have access to, you know, software, to accounts. You know, there are servers that can handle the, you know, the weight of the data. Still, you know, some of the simulations that we run in our papers, you know, they can take up to weeks. But that's kind of how much I've gone. Sometimes, you know, the code will just stop running because you know, it's set up to just. In 14 days, and you know, and the maybe the analysis isn't done yet, but I mean, it's definitely something that's doable. And I think that, you know, there is a sense in which maybe our profession as economists has become more and more sort of being accustomed and being ready to learn new softwares to learn new stay up to date with the newest commands that some folks who are more tech savvy than me put out. There's a lot of user written kind of experimentations with softwares that really can handle these big data, and I think that's just great. And to me, sort of the biggest barrier is, especially when working with health data, children's data, right? There's definitely privacy concerns are really important. I think it's also really important that we're able to study these phenomena. So of course, balancing those needs is really, really hard. I think, IT departments in all universities are doing a great job. I think the governments, local agencies are sort of learning to work with researchers, are learning that, we can be of help in answering some of these questions. Because sometimes, if you think about it, these, government administrations, the public administrations, they're sitting on this throw of data. They themselves don't have the capacity or the software or the resources or the staffing to analyze them, right? And so sometimes, one of the models that I've been using a lot that I learned as a postdoc in Chicago and in working with governments is really sort of offering technical assistance, right? Like sometimes I come in, I have my research question, which I think is really important, but maybe, the person on the other side of the phone, that's not the question that they need to ask today, right? Like I want to know whether distance to doctors affects screening rates for children. They maybe don't even know how many children they've screened, the past year. Because they, for example, what I learned in Chicago is they had no idea. They had never done a cohort level analysis. So they knew they were screening, 60,000 kids a year. I'm making the number up.
Yeah.
But they didn't know of the children born in 2018.
Right.
How many have we screened by today? Mm-hmm. Right? Because they didn't have the data set up. They had never linked it to the birth records. And so really, in order to answer my question, I had to link birth records and lead screening records. And then what I did was, run three lines of extra code that took me 5 minutes to give, to give them the answer that they wanted and that helped them sort of do their planning better. And so I think that really, we can be a resource for governments for better policymaking, even with very, very simple answers that, we wouldn't even classify as research, mm-hmm. just a simple number that they didn't know. And so there's really fruitful avenues for collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like a really cooperative way of working. And what's next on the list for you? You mentioned earlier on that you're thinking of looking at in much more detail at some of those inequality drivers. Is that the next project for you?
Yeah, there's definitely a few projects kind of continuing on this question of inequality, continuing on this question of sort of, thinking about of all the inputs, of all the interactions that children have, what are the most sort of consequential, for their growth. So, looking at these children, these careers of teachers in these interactions, looking at also policies that could ameliorate, damages from pollutions, from different pollution sources, policies for, children with disabilities in school, how to help and support them, do kids who have been lead poisoned but who have access to extra support, fare better, and so on. But also kind of thinking about, what happens when we actually remediate and clean up some of these, pollution sources. Are we benefiting the residents, or are we sort of spurring what, the incoming of richer folks? I think we always hear this term of environmental gentrification. It's something that's sort of, it's really difficult to define. It's really difficult to study, but we're hoping actually to start a project in the UK with UK data, where we would be able to follow children as they go throughout the school system. We have their residence address, so we can see sort of, after pollution sources are eliminated, do they stay? Do they benefit? Do they get better? Or do they get pushed to other pollution, polluted areas, polluted neighborhoods, because house prices go up too much, parents can't afford the rents anymore. So yeah.
Fantastic. No, thank you ever so much. I think that's been a really fascinating insight into both a really topical problem, but also how economics and how the work that you're doing and colleagues across the world really are doing to focus on what's happening and put numbers around it and really give politicians something to work with. So Dirk, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for taking part in the podcast series. Brilliant.
Thank you very much. Bye.
You have been listening to Warwick Econ Sounds, a podcast series from the Department of Economics at Warwick University. Please follow the links on our website for further information about Dr. Ludwika's work on the economics of the environment and public health.